Welcome to Crime Wire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Mercy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. Crime Wire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. Call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate tonight simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the Crime Wire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
And tonight we're going to have a special guest with us, none other than Crime Wire consultant and statement analyst Peter Hyatt. Peter, welcome back to Crime Wire.
Hi, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
I think you should explain statement analysis or have Peter do it because people don't know what that is.
Yeah, what I was going to say, we're going to be discussing some cases, but before we get into that, Peter, for people who are not familiar with you and what you do, could you give us a little description of statement analysis, exactly what it is and how you accomplish it, in about a minute? Only kidding.
Okay.
Take whatever time you need.
The statement analysis is the scientific study of words where we are able to discern whether someone is telling the truth or someone is being deceptive. And not only that, but the form of verbal polygraphy allows the analyst to glean missing information. So we look at a statement and we analyze the words according to the principles of analysis, really, and the laws of grammar. And we attempt to see if the person is speaking from memory and revisiting the event, or are they now in the present and possibly making up things or adding to it. So it's like a polygraph machine, but it's for words instead of measuring the body reaction.
And how long have you been doing statement analysis?
My first touch of it was in 1997. Dr. Susan Adams had an excellent article regarding it, but I've been studying it more the last few years of my life and incorporated into my work, probably the last 10 years.
Do you get people that say to you, you know, because it's not admissible in court, oh, that's just hogwash? I mean, I think it's important sometimes in a polygraph, because isn't that part of investigation or a toolbox for investigation that's really important for law enforcement when they're putting together these cases when they first happen?
Yes, and in fact, we can look at it two ways. One way is that everyone, including a jury, uses statement analysis in some form. So if I say to you, for instance, that I went to the store alone tonight, I wasn't with anyone, and then later on I say we were at the store and you heard me say the word we, you would conclude that something is wrong. Either I am lying about being alone or I'm trying to be deceptive, but something is not correct. So in that sense, it's a listening skill. But it's importantly, it's an investigatory tool which can drive an investigator to the left or to the right and guide them what they're doing. And so in some of these cases where in some of the missing child cases, for instance, a statement analyst can listen to what the parent of the missing child says, or a suspect, for instance, and tell you whether or not the parent is speaking the truth or the parent is being deceptive. And in tonight's cases, I think that's quite relevant. So as a science, it's not admissible in court. Yet, in court, lawyers that are trained in it and prosecutors that are trained in it, defense attorneys that are trained in it, and even jurors who have an awareness of it will really subconsciously use it just the same.
And, Peter, it's true, isn't it, that you can not only listen to people talk, listen to their statements and analyze them, you can also look at written statements and basically do the same thing, right, do that analysis.
Yeah, in fact, one skill comes from the other. Listening is very difficult because it's on the fly and it's happening quickly. So the way to learn this type of analysis is through the written statement. And it's the written statement which we can look at as being a person's perception of what happened. And we enter into the statement, we allow the person to guide us. And Denny, it's amazing. We have an exercise that we do with everyone that wants to learn, is we ask them to write out a statement of what they did. We ask them to choose like a Saturday or Sunday when they were off from work. From the time they got up in the morning to the time they went to bed, write down what you did. And then we do analysis with them following the same principles that we use on every case. And what is the amazing part of it is that people don't realize how much personal information they yield in a statement that way. They leak out all sorts of highly personal, but sometimes even embarrassing information about their private lives that they simply didn't realize they were letting out. We all do it. That's the bad news. The good news is that most people aren't listening to the linguistic indicators that we are trained for, but we all do it. And so when we have someone who is a bit skeptical about it, I will sit them down, I'll ask them to write out a statement, what they did, and they know it's going to be analyzed. And then about 15 or 20 minutes later, I return with some analysis, and I point out things to them in their private lives. And it's never wrong. It's never something that isn't shocking. Even my wife used it. My wife Heather wrote out a statement for me, and knowing full well, she's very good at analysis herself, but she wrote out a statement about her day. And as she went through it, a couple hours later, she was amazed at what she let out, personal struggles and even some medical things that she didn't realize that she was leaking out. So it's an amazing tool. It goes way back to ancient times. I've been on the show before and I've talked about its first known usage in antiquity was the case of Solomon with the two mothers that were bickering over the son, and they each had a baby boy. Two mothers were living together in a tent. One of them had rolled over and suffocated her child. So the next morning, the mother switched the babies as they were waking up. And when the mother realized that the child that was laying on her chest was not her child, the dead child, but the other woman's child, they bickered over it and they argued. It was heard, I suppose, by local courts and local judges. They couldn't decide which baby belonged to which. It was before the DNA testing that we have today. They looked alike. They were about the same age. And there were no eyewitnesses. So eventually it was appealed all the way up to the king's court, King Solomon, and there was at least a population of 1 million people. So this is quite a developed nation at this time. And as many people know from their Sunday school days, Solomon said, "Bring me a sword and I'll cut the baby in half. I'll give each mother a half." And one woman said, "Well, that's fine with me." And the other woman said, "No, no, no, let the living child go with her." And that was obviously the mother. But what they don't realize is that before he called for a sword in a very casual way, what he did was he highlighted each woman's argument. He said, the one woman says, the living son is mine, but the dead child is hers. The other woman says, no, the dead child is hers, the living child is mine, reversing the order in which they spoke. So if I were to ask you who your children are, you would likely name them in chronological order. Well, we have a tendency to name our children before we name someone else's children. So what Solomon did was he showed how verbally they had already given it away. But because no one was listening, he needed more of a sign. So he said, in a very casual way, bring me a sword, cut the baby in half, and then we'll have lunch. And it'll be all over in a little while. And there was never an expectation of murdering a child there. But what he was doing was showing how their language gave it away, but if not their language, then their maternal instinct. So
can
we
can I ask you too that in that context as well, on a crime scene or in a trauma event, do you think that officers who come to these scenes, in having statement analysis before they get there, would have the ability to perhaps glean from things? I'll never forget, I can't remember the case, where you said how the person that called in the missing child gave the sequence of the order of the missing child, and then afterthought that the child was missing, that they said everything else but.
Yeah, in fact, an officer, officers that are trained are able to pick some of these things up right on the fly. A teenage girl gets out of comes all disheveled and she's filthy and she's crying hysterically and she says, "He raped me." We drove into the woods. He raped me. We drove back. He threw me out of his car. And immediately the officer knew when he heard the pronoun we, he was able to then discern that there is no we, which means unity and cooperation between a rapist and his victim. So by using the word we, he knew that she was lying, and he confronted her, and she said, yeah, I went out with a boy. I wasn't supposed to go out. My father had forbidden me, and that sort of thing, just on the fly. So even like that, or the 911 call, you can ask yourself, and this is a really simple principle, if your child was missing and you called 911, what would you say? What would be the first thing you'd say?
My God, help me right now. Please help me. I don't think you'd be able to talk.
Sure. You would probably not say, hello, how are things? Fine, thank you. How are you? By the way, I'd like to report a missing person. It would sound goofy. So we know that when callers, like a domestic homicide, for instance, when they call or start with a greeting, there's something very wrong. We also know right off the bat, someone says the words, I'm sorry, in a 911 call about a domestic homicide. If those words slip in anywhere, it's usually because they are sorry and they have a reason to be sorry. So we'll note the order in which they speak. We'll note the verb tenses that they use. The one thing that statement analysis does not do is it does not listen to the voice inflection. And this was really highlighted recently in the case of the missing 6-year-old Isabel Chellis. It did when the 911 calls were released, the father was heard chuckling on the tape. And he was very casual and really just cracking a joke. And then the mother gets on, and the mother sounds hysterical. They're both deceptive. What people are doing is they're listening to it. And, Susan, I can't tell you when someone is crying real tears or crocodile tears. I was raised with 7 sisters. I don't know. I can't tell. I can't tell if the forehead is squinched up enough or not. But I can tell you this, that a mother that has killed her child who's crying may be crying because she misses her child. She may be crying because she's sorry for what she did. She may be crying because she's caught. To us, in the world of listening to words, we have an expression. The subject is dead. The statement is alive. So the person's voice matters nothing. The person's inflection, intentions, anything, makes no difference to us at all. It's the words that they choose that tell us what we need to know.
Peter, I'd like to talk more about the Chellis case in a minute, but before we move more into that, I have a question regarding first responders, a first officer at a scene, for example, at a crime scene. Do you think an officer who is not familiar with statement analysis and perhaps doesn't actually take a statement or statements from people at the scene but does a narrative report?
Yes.
In lieu of taking statements from the actual person, how often do you think they might miss keywords? In other words, if you just read a narrative report from the police officer that doesn't actually reflect the statements or comments quoted directly from the witness or the person at the scene, how much can be lost, if anything, in those situations?
The first responder is an interesting aspect because with training, they can increase their level of being able to hear certain keywords, just learning how to grab onto pronouns especially and verb tenses, and they can know it. And the training that we do for them is geared in such a way that we move quickly from the written statement to just the oral first interview, first response. We often find that there are officers who have done this for a number of years who are very good at it. And because they're very good at it, they have a certain instinct to, they love the fact that we're able to bring them something that really just helps them as a tool. And they say, you know, I was good at this all along, but now you're telling me how to do it, and it's really working out well for me. And so it's kind of a neat thing. If someone doesn't have a really good instinct for that, it can be developed. This is not a difficult thing to learn. It really isn't. It just takes a lot of practice. I'll give you a kind of an example on the fly, and this is from one of the trainers that they were giving a class on interviewing in the FBI Academy. And the trainer had noticed that one of the young men was slacking off, and she said, you know, am I boring you here? Or, did you get enough sleep last night? And he said, oh, man, there was some party last night in the dorm room. There was this girl, and she was dancing like crazy, and the music was loud, and the woman finally went to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the trainer said, tell me, what happened at 3 o'clock that changed the girl into a woman? And the fellow blushed at that point. It's that type of learning, especially pronouns, that really works well. There was, I just shared the story recently from, and this is from LSI, Avinon Sapir is he's the grandfather of all statement analysis. He was an Israeli polygrapher who brought it to our country, and he's just world recognized. Well, he was giving a class, and there was a female Israeli polygrapher who said, I love your course. It's wonderful. Everything about it is just fantastic, except one thing. You said that in a statement, if someone doesn't say, my husband Bob, for instance, that it means it's a poor relationship. So if someone doesn't introduce their spouse in a statement, it's indicative of a poor relationship. She said, I have news for you. You know the word for husband in Hebrew means master. And on my deathbed, and not before, would I ever say, my husband Bob. No way, and not just me, but my girlfriends. It's a cultural thing. We never say, my husband. And the instructor said, no, it is primal. The word my is a pronoun that you learn instinctively. We are creatures of ownership. We take ownership of what is ours. If you don't say my husband, Bob, it means that there is a poor relationship. I cannot give you a pass for culture. And she said, well, we'll just agree to disagree because I like everything else in your course except that. Well, after the class was over and they were talking, he said, I'd like to show you how to use a computer to analyze by using a word count. And she said, oh, computer, my husband has one of those. And he said, uh-oh. You just said your husband, and you had said you would never say that word ever, and you said it about a computer, and I told you it was a bad relationship. Therefore, I think your husband is cheating, and he's using the computer. And she broke down and cried. And later on, one of her friends said, you don't know the half of it. He's on the computer all morning, all night, all during the day, doesn't sleep because he's always cheating and carrying on the computer, and they're headed for a divorce. So it may be something that people will deny. It may be something that they feel, well, they get a pass for culture. Nope. The pronouns that we speak are instinctive. If you were to call me and say to me, hi, Peter, this is Denny. Denny says, how you doing? And it would sound so awkward that you use your own name. You've used the word I millions of times. You've used the word Denny not very many times. You're much more comfortable using the word I. Therefore, while you're speaking, if you say I, and then later on change yourself to we, and then back to I, pronouns are never mistaken. If you have a change in pronoun like that, I'll call you on the deception. You are being deceptive for one reason or another. I may not know why you're deceptive, but I know you're deceptive. So the pronouns have been learned in us since we were 2 or 3 years old, and when you say my dada, my baba, my anything, it is instinctive. It's part of a reflectiveness in our language, and pronouns never lie. So when O.J. Simpson said, for those of you who believe in my guilt, when he was able to take ownership of guilt, there is his confession. It's my guilt.
So we can't get these people arrested. We can't, because it's all circumstantial. It's words, but it's enough when the investigators listen at the beginning. You jumped right into Isabel Sellis, who's 6 years old, immediately when this happened, and you smelled a rat. Was it what he said? Was it an interview you saw him? What came to that conclusion for you?
Well, actually, it's almost like all these other kidnapping cases where I hear the report and I say to myself, oh, no, please don't be another lying parent. And I heard that you went missing. And I waited for the parents to make a statement, and they didn't. And I waited the next day for them to make a statement, and they didn't. I waited for day number 3 to make a statement, and they didn't. I waited for day number 4, and they didn't make a statement. So I said to myself and began to write on the blog, Houston, there is a problem. When your child wanders off you in Walmart, or the child wanders off to you in the forest, or the child wanders off to you from the beach, the first thing a parent does is call out to the child. The same thing is with a kidnapping. They have a natural reflex to call out to the child. If a parent doesn't call out to the child, we have a problem. Well, after 5 days with media intensity upon them saying, why won't they speak out after reporting their child kidnapped, they finally went to the microphones, and when they spoke, immediately we knew that there was deception there. And believe it or not, it was because of the mother speaking that we had the deception noted first. She refused to use the word I. And even when parents are sitting together, speaking for each other, a we is common. But a child stolen from its mother, the mother, it's very personal. She's going to use the pronoun I. When she refused to use the pronoun I knew there was a cover-up. So that was my first indication of deception. And it came from her, not from him.
Biological father of this child?
He is the biological father of this child, yes.
And she's a biological mother?
Yes. As far as we know, we've had a few curveballs in the story, but yes.
You've got blood stains found in the bedroom. They belong to her. You've got blood where in the bathroom too, I think, or a curtain or something.
Well, no, we're not sure yet in terms of the blood test yet. We know the blood has been, they call it apparently blood, and we're still waiting for the test results on who the blood belongs to.
Any reports of domestic violence to the house ever? Did anybody check that?
There is a CPS history. We learned that. And we believe there. That we don't know because Arizona State is not allowed to release that information. So this stuff leaks out. They'll confirm that CPS was there previously, but they won't say why. The laws of confidentiality protect children. We know there was substance abuse involved. We don't know much, but they come across. Go ahead, Susan. I'm sorry.
By whom? Was it the father, the mother? Who's got the teenager?
No, we have heard that it was the father who had, I believe, an OUI in his background.
Do we know what he does for a living, the father?
Yes, they work in the medical profession. I think one is a dental hygienist. I think they both work somehow in the medical profession.
Do you think that he could have been sexually active with the child somehow?
I do.
Okay.
I do. I think either that or we're looking at it because I think both parents are involved. And in a case like this where both parents are involved, we sometimes see an unintended death. If I call it accidental death, I'll get a lot of angry emails. An unintended death, meaning that discipline that went too far, discipline that turned into an accident, one of the kids in a prank or something had gone awry, hurt her, and she died, and then the parents conspire to cover up. That happens probably more times than people realize. It certainly happens more times than a stranger abduction. But here we had the father and the mother called 911. The father said that his daughter had been abducted. When he was asked, why do you think that she has been abducted, his word, he said, I have no idea. So when people heard the 911 calls, the reaction was very, very strong. But here's another thing, Susan, not to go too far out of chronological order. Child Protective Services received information from the Arizona police, and they presented the parents with a piece of paper called a safety plan, whatever it may be called there, but in essence, it's a safety plan. The safety plan said, you are to agree voluntarily to have no contact with your sons. If you have contact with your sons, we will take this information before a judge and seek custody of your children. If you agree, while we investigate, to have no contact, no phone contact, no supervised visitation, nothing, then we will not seek custody until we learn more about the investigation. Now, a parent can say, you take your safety agreement and jump in a lake. You can't tell me I can't see my sons. In this case, the parents agreed. What this tells us is that they do not want the information that police shared with Child Protective Services to go before a judge. it is very damning information. So he is under a no-contact rule with his own sons. They are with Rebecca Chellis, his wife, and he can't even call them on the phone. So that tells us that the police know, in the very least, that he poses jeopardy to those sons. And one is a teenager who is, at that age, is capable of self-protection. That's how serious this is. And that he has tried to coach them because they would not be in no contact, even they would have supervised contact. Sex offenders have supervised contact with their kids. This guy has no contact with his kids.
Was
so
he
whatever
in the
information
house when she died, or when she was he living there when she was reported abducted?
Yes, both parents
okay.
Living together with two sons.
This is a hypothetical because I've seen this, so I'm going to play devil's advocate. Let's say I'm a battered woman in this situation. I'm also fearful I'm going to die. I have been told over and over and over. Maybe police have come. Maybe they haven't. I don't know what to do with the information, so I might react that way. There's a case. I just went blank. It was in Illinois. I want to say 2007. He owned a bunch of pottery stores. And he had murdered his child upstairs. Mom is with a six-year-old. She realizes, and almost to save her own life, because he has an injury to himself, they go to the hospital. And then that's when she calls the neighbor and says, go check on my daughter. And they find her dead. It was a sexual relationship, and it was upstairs in the upstairs bathroom. But that's the only way she could save her and the other child. Do you think that in this case, there's a small remote possibility that the mother is trying to do this because she knows she could die? That happens once in a while. We're going to bring it up.
Yes. No, that is a scenario which I think that had to be examined by police. I think in this case, it's been discounted. In fact, she is probably the dominant one in the relationship. That's what the body language experts tell me, that she's the dominant one. In terms of the speech, she is clearly the dominant one. What bothers me regarding this is that they claimed that the six-year-old girl was sleeping with her brothers normally, and of one of which is a teenager, even though she has her own room. And the alleged kidnapper picked the one night that she was sleeping in her own bed, was able to get into the house without waking anybody and their two or three dogs, and get out without leaving any trace DNA, without waking anybody, and found the right room and everything else. It's an implausible case. It's like the baby Lisa kidnapping. It was silly off the charts. It was then that they have refused to tell us how they did on the polygraph. Now, when someone passes a polygraph, they climb to the top of their house and they shout out their results. When they withhold the information about the polygraph, they do so for a reason. They don't want to be embarrassed. So we have the police are focused in on them. To me, it seems like they're just crossing their T's and dotting their I's. I know sometimes I sound like the voice of optimism, but what I'm hoping for is that that the parents will speak out more. However, once that 911 call was released, they have just shut up completely. Here's why I was hoping they would speak out more. If a social worker, a school teacher, a concerned parent, they know there's certain symbols and things that happen when a child is sexually abused, for instance. They notice that a child is suddenly washing his or her hands every 10 minutes, and the teacher is really concerned because this little girl washed her hands once a day like anyone else, and now she's washing her hands six or seven times a day. It's a signal. It may mean their hands are dirty, but it may mean that she was sexually abused. There's a correlation between water, for instance, and sexual abuse. There is, and linguistically, there is the same pattern. So if you had say a sister with mental retardation and she was in a group home and she suddenly starts washing herself all the time, you're really nervous that she may have been sexually abused, and you're going to want some tests done and some investigation done, because people with MR are many times more likely to be sexually abused than anyone else in the population. They're just exploited. It's a terrible thing, but it's a reality. They're not saying that the washing of hands is sexual abuse. What they're saying is, I want to explore sexual abuse because of the washing of the hands. We have the same thing linguistically. When someone says, I got up this morning and I got dressed and went to work. You say, well, did you take a shower? I say, yeah, of course I took a shower. Well, why didn't you tell me that? It wasn't important. When it's important enough for someone to mention certain things, then we know statistically that something may be wrong. Now, I'm going to tell you something that might upset listeners, but this is just something that is found statistically. When someone was abused in childhood, for them, when they talk about their day, when they talk about their lives, they often mention doors opening and closing. The door opens.
Or the sound of them. Or the
sure.
Sound, how the door sounded.
Right. It would be very unusual for you to say to me, when I went to work this morning, I closed the door behind me. Or when I went into a room, I opened the door. People just normally say, I went into a room and that was it. When someone feels the need to say, I opened the door and went into the room, we find there, oftentimes, they themselves were a victim of sexual abuse in childhood, and those expressions stay with them their whole lives. When someone refers to themselves growing up as a child, I would say, oh, I was a little boy, or I was a child, it's often an indication that they were abused with a high likelihood of sexual abuse in the factor, in the equation. Well, in analysis, if you said to me, well, at the end of my day, I went to bed and that was it. So, okay. Someone else might say, I went to bed, I turned off the lights, and I went to sleep. And you say, well, why did someone mention lights? In statements, we have found over really 30, 40 years of research that when lights are mentioned, there's sexual activity playing in the person's mind. Someone may say, they mentioned the lights turning off. One detective once said, oh, no, that's not true. I just wrote that I turned off the lights because I did. And he said, that doesn't mean anything was wrong sexually. And a couple weeks later, I'm sorry, then he said, hey, you're not saying that I'm impotent, are you? And then a couple weeks later, he sent an email or a fax or something and said, I just want you to know, the lights are on again, you know, kind of intimating things are better with the wife. When people mention lights turning off, for instance, it often is an indication of some kind of sexual problem. So not many people mention them in statements, but when they do come up, we're on cue. So two things. We have a door opening, closing, and we have lights on and off. Susan, you remember the case of JonBenet Ramsey?
Yeah.
John Ramsey and Patsy Ramsey were asked, how did you find the body on television? And he said, I went down to the basement, I opened the door, mm-hmm. I turned the light on, and mm-hmm. there she was.
That's right.
Yeah. There were other linguistic indications of sexual abuse
and
going on.
And that bothered me when that was said. So I'd like to know, before we move on to another case, why don't we have a law, Denny and Peter, if these children are in this home, whether it's Baby Alea, whether it's it doesn't matter. In all of these cases, the parent was there. Why can't there be a law? Because these children can't speak for themselves. They can't fund, especially the toddlers that suddenly go missing and that aliens took them into the middle of the night. That automatically, if that should happen after a certain period of time, circumstantial or not, why can't there be an arrest at some point when there doesn't look like there's a break-in, when everything points to that, why aren't we more diligent for the children across the country and have a law almost like a predator pedophile? Denny, do you think that should be in place?
Well, yeah, you know, we talk about cases all the time. We're talking about some tonight here where you think, where you hear, well, all the indications are, but they just, meaning law enforcement, just doesn't have quite enough to make an arrest. Well, I don't know. It seems to me in a lot of these cases, they might actually have enough to make an arrest. It depends on the individual jurisdiction and who's running it and who's calling the shots. But some of these cases, I think they do have a probable cause, and why people are being arrested, I can't explain that. I really think I think in some cases where what we have right now, arrests could be made and they aren't being made.
Yeah, and actually, if you look at it, there's a case that you mentioned this now, this weekend, on Friday in Kentucky, a one-year-old baby was reported missing by his babysitter. This is baby William Cunningham. And on Saturday or Sunday, the babysitter over the weekend changed her story about being kidnapped, and eventually she led detectives to the baby's body. The baby's dead. Now, they arrested her on some very minor charges, like moving a corpse, something like that, just really minor charges, nothing about homicide or anything else. So right away the reaction of the people is, you know, has the DA just gone mad? When actually, Susan, what I think they may be doing in Kentucky is arresting her now, getting her in jail, then getting the information and investigation going before a defense attorney shuts it down. So maybe that's a case where that's happening. With Child Protective Services, in a lot of states, when a child goes missing or there's a report of this type of shenanigans going on, Child Protective Services will move in, will have the children go and stay with a relative while an investigation goes on. The baby Ayla case here in my home state of Maine, the other children
are still with the mothers. And you know, this, you and I had talked before, and it was, you know, what really happened, and some missing persons organizations were upset by a show that you and I had, because they said, you know, we're still looking, there's still hope. In some situations, and this is just my belief because of my own background, you've got to get real. And
yes.
And it's not about being accusatory, it's about what the facts are. And the general public, when they armchair quarterback some of this stuff and they want to shoot messengers for just saying, this is what it is. That's
yep.
it. It they don't understand. You have to work enough of these cases. You have to see them. You have to live them and breathe them to understand the pattern of conduct and what happens. And it's not to say, yes, there is hope under the circumstances with the Reynolds case, because it's in Maine. You know, the circumstantial evidence, isn't it overwhelming? In this case?
It is overwhelming. As a matter of fact, in some of these cases, what I have said from the beginning is, like Solomon, copying Solomon, that if a mother is able to articulate about her missing baby in the past tense, the mother knows or believes the child is dead. Then you ask the next question is, have the police told the mother or father anything that would indicate your child is dead? If there's not, then we're looking at some pretty guilty language coming out of them. We saw this in Susan Smith, Casey Anthony, stepmother Misty Croslin. We saw this in the baby Ayla case of Maine here with Justin DiPietro, the father. I mean, talk about a simple case, but there is a reason I think there's a delay. But where the father referenced her in the past tense from the beginning. This was another case where he wanted to report her kidnapping, but then did not come out and say, hey, Ayla, I'm looking for you, or kidnapper, let's negotiate. None of those things existed because there was no kidnapper. This made my blood run cold. 6 weeks before he reported her missing, the unemployed single father of a healthy toddler bought life insurance against the baby's life. He then telegraphed his plans by sending text messages to the baby's mother saying, I sure hope she doesn't go missing. And lo and behold, 6 weeks later, Insurance Investigation 101, baby went missing for a $25,000 life insurance policy, which may not sound like a lot of money around the country. In Maine, that's a lot of money because to bury a baby in Maine for him wouldn't have cost a penny. At the maximum, maybe $500, but state would have paid for the baby's funeral. So that's not even a viable option. This is an unemployed little bully who is rumored to be a street drug dealer who would like to be like the Sopranos, but he can't get over the fact that he's from Waterville, Maine. You know, he's in Hicktown, Maine, and who thought this would be clever. His girlfriend's sister got arrested with a large cache of drugs that she could not have money to pay for. She owes some drug dealer a great deal of money, And it sounds to me like this was a way to get them out of trouble. And so 6 weeks later, she goes missing. She had bruises on her face. She had some injuries to her arms and legs that were indicative of twisting and turning during diaper changing. And then lastly, he fell on her, fractured, severely fractured her arm, did not seek medical attention for 24 hours, probably because he had to sober up or whatever. And when he finally did, she was in a cast, and this battered, poor little child then went missing 6 weeks after life insurance policy. That really tells me everything I need to know. Then we have the blood that was found in her basement was a significant amount. So we ask ourselves, why is there no arrest? And this is what I think has happened. They had three adults, the father, the paternal aunt, and the father's girlfriend. All three are sticking with the stranger abduction story. Who do they charge? Do they charge in concert, all three, or do they get one of them to turn and charge one of them? What I don't understand and I cannot defend is why on God's green earth does the aunt, she's about 25 years old, Alicia DiPietro, still have her baby, and the girlfriend, Courtney Roberts, how does she have her baby? That is just inexcusable. They were
present.
Let me
ask you a question real quick before this goes, because the chat room's busy. Was there a cadaver hit for the Reynolds girl in the Dip house?
Dip is short for DiPietro.
Okay. Somebody's asking if there was cadaver hits.
Good question. I don't remember if there was or not.
Okay. Did they even bring dogs in at all?
Yes, I'm sure they did.
Okay.
Sometimes the cases begin to blur one after the next, but the amount of blood that was spilled was more than she could have survived. Police would reveal, they said, she met foul play in that home where these three adults are lying via withholding information. So the police have said everything. They failed their polygraphs. Everything is there. It's just a mountain of circumstantial evidence. People are wondering, is the district attorney's office afraid to prosecute? Are they afraid to go up against private attorneys? Is it because there's three defendants and they don't know which one to charge? I don't know the answer to those questions. I don't
Danny, what happened to everybody round you up? And I know you've done this in your days as an investigator. Round everybody up. We're going down to the station. What happened to that?
Yeah, bring them all in and see if one of them cracks. To let them know they're all suspects and facing homicide charges, and see if one of them says, "Hey, I'll tell you what. I know what happened. I wasn't in on it, but, you know, I don't want to get charged here. What can I do? You know, try to get somebody to make a deal." And Peter, I got two questions. I want to back up for just a second to the Chellis case. Do I understand correctly that the only indication of the so-called abduction came from the father's call when he said, my daughter's been abducted? What made you say that? Well, I have no idea. But was there ever anything, you said there was no DNA or anything found at the scene, and was there any type of ransom note or contact from a kidnapper, or was his word the only word that this was a kidnap or an abduction?
Yeah, they basically ruled out abduction. They said that she didn't leave the house on her own. There's no evidence of abduction. There's no ransom note. There's no kidnapping. There's no ties that anyone can bring out that would even intimate a kidnapping. At this point, it appears that police know full well that she met foul play inside that home. There was the next-door neighbor lives very close to that house, and she was awakened at 6:30 that morning by hearing male voices going in and out, that sort of thing. So I personally think that that he had help, that this was planned, where the wife went off to work that morning and said, "You take care of this. This is your problem." And he and perhaps the brother-in-law, who was the family spokesman, he made the first statement for the family, and it was off the charts bizarre, talking about the way he described a six-year-old child was just inappropriate. Well, I think they had help, and this may be a case where she could have been a victim of sexual abuse, she could have been an unattended death, and they're covering up. But it is very similar, I think, to the Baby Lisa case in Missouri, where they gave a fake story of kidnapping. If there was a kidnapping, they had no intention of calling out to the kidnapper for negotiations.
And with Ayla Reynolds, you said that her arm was badly fractured and wasn't reported for approximately 24 hours. Would that or could that have been grounds for Child Protective or somebody to have removed that child at that point? Or wasn't that bad enough for CPS to investigate or to make a move?
CPS was involved, but due to the confidentiality laws in Maine, we don't know what the result of investigation was. There is some intimation that he may have been told, if you want the child, you've got to stay at your mother's house. So he moved from an apartment in Portland, which was a kind of a known place of drug activity, I've been told, to living with his mother in Waterville. The mother is another interesting character. She went on CNN and she said that she heard absolutely nothing that night, and there was no party that night. Nothing out of the ordinary happened. We just had dinner, and that was it. And she didn't hear anything that night. And the next day, she was forced to go back on CNN and admit that she wasn't even in the home that night. So when someone,
right.
Yeah, so you know, the apples don't fall far from the trees. And,
well,
and
when these people get, I mean, where is this woman's conscience? That's one. It's her granddaughter. How dare she cover up and lie? This is a child who no one is speaking out for, no one is helping, and they stand by these killers, family member after, and not just in these cases, but other ones. What's the mindset of Emma to try to pull stuff like this?
Yeah, I think that there is a certain element of guilt that she's projecting in terms of her son being raised in a very violent upbringing. He and his brother were known as bullies. I spoke to one woman whose son was a victim of their bullying, and one day he did what happens to bullies, is they pop them, and the bullies pop like a balloon. So they're not big, but they're kind of weaselly, dirty brothers. And so I imagine that the grandmother has her own issues, but I never forget this. When someone lies, they have a need to lie. So for her, she was more interested in protecting her son, in the very least, than about the grandchild. So this is the life insurance policy just rips me up inside when I think about it, because I wanted to believe that he dropped her down the stairs or something terrible happened, even unintentional but negligent, where he was drunk. But the idea of killing for a life insurance policy, and we know it happens, and someone recently wrote a bunch of cases where parents or step-parents did this for money. It's just the in criminology, we have three basic motives for crimes, and one of them, number one, is greed. The other one is power, and then sex. And the greed is underlining of all of them, because with enough money, you can get power and have sex and that sort of thing. In this case, it appears to be greed, and I just don't know where the prosecutors are at in terms of what they're going to do next. Very strange.
Have they actually collected the insurance at this point, or where does that stand? Is that...
Oh, no, I don't think he'd dare enter a claim yet, because I understand that after she went missing, he tried to stop the child support payments to the mother. He called the state of Maine and wanted to put the brakes on child support payments, which was really a kind of a classless move that should have spoken to those closest to him. But realistically, everything about him revolves around money. And so I think this was a crime for money, and that's why he could do something as Bush League as literally what he did.
You know, Susan raised the question a few minutes ago about arrests, and, you know, you say that your blood gets boiling, and, you know, just sitting here listening, and I'm getting fired up. I mean, you know, again, like you say, you can't explain the lack, you know, what the reasoning behind, in this particular case, the failure to make some arrests. Maybe it's a strategic thing, and we just aren't privy to enough information to be able to reach that conclusion. But short of that, it seems like there's plenty of stuff there. Susan, do you agree? I mean, other than perhaps a confession, we're going to talk about a confession in another case in a minute, but you know, how much more do they need? Will there ever come a point where they can start locking people up?
Was the last person to be in that house. So there is everything that's done, pattern of conduct. There's everything that's there in this entire case, and I would have just rounded them all up and said, let's go. I think that the grandmother, there's no word for someone like that. You don't hear any remorse. You don't see tears. You don't seem to be looking for this child because the child's dead. And because, you know, you've got a mother, I can't recall, was the mother out of the child's life for a little bit for treatment or something?
That's correct.
Okay, and she has been doing what she can. She's gone to Lost and Missing. She's gone to various organizations to get the child registered. She, you know, regardless of, no one's past of their drug abuse or that type of activity should play into anything, especially when there's a missing child and it happens. And in this mother's case, I think that she's been wrongly railroaded in a lot of ways by the public, possibly by law enforcement. And she's broken. I mean, she's looking and trying to do everything she can. And it's the story of, well, if one doesn't break, then they're all not going to break. And what should have happened immediately is and they should have been rounded up, brought down, and just questioned and questioned and questioned. I know it sounds crazy, but do you remember the old Dragnet show? That's how police used to do their work. That is actually what used to happen, is that that's how cases were put together, because they brought them in. It didn't give them, oh, well, we'll see. I mean, what's happened to police investigators these days? Is it because they're going to lawyer up? Is it because they're afraid of being sued? When you have a child under a specific age, it is your duty, and the state should come in right away and protect that and make every assumption that the person, yes, is innocent until proven guilty, but if you're responsible, just like Pete and Denny, if your child or my child misses school, the parent gets arrested for truancy. Isn't a child's life worth more than that?
Well, I don't want to date you, but I know that you're older than 30, and I know that Denny's older than 31. When you were in school,
thank you, Peter.
You were both afraid of your teacher. You wouldn't talk back. You're today, kids, I had a group of kids no older than 12 or 13 call a woman a bitch. And I went over to them. I said, who said that? Thinking that they would at least be intimidated and apologize or something. Instead, they rallied up against me, and they dared me to hit them. They said, you won't do anything. They called me all sorts of vile names. There's no fear. It's like entitlement on steroids. There's no fear. There's no concern. And we see that today where people just, you know, if I was a 24-year-old kid and I had been a witness to a crime like this, I would be down at the police station crying my eyes out, scared out of my mind. We have a culture today where it's like Casey Anthony. She said, you know, I work at Universal. Yeah, let's go down there. Let's take a ride. Sure, guys. She was cool as a cucumber driving in a car with seasoned detectives. Yeah, this is it. Yeah, right, those gates, good. Front door, right down the hallway. Finally get all the way down the hall to her, quote-unquote, office. The gig is up. She's like, nah, I don't really work here. And so instead of breaking down and being done, she had no fear. And you know what? It paid off in her case. And this criminal mind of the younger generation seems utterly unafraid and disrespectful. We see everywhere across America in Little League parks and in hockey arenas signs about bad behavior addressed to parents, not to kids. Something's gone very wrong with us. So I think that people just don't fear law enforcement like they did. They feel like no one ever has to own up to anything. There's never any consequences for anything. And there's an emboldenment that's gone on. And I'll tell you, we're paying a price for it.
Is it social media? Is that a big part of it? Is it watching these shows, what is Snooki Wookie and these Housewives and all these other shows, that these reality TV things where people do bad things and it seems to be okay and people want to be like them? Or Kardashian with her butt hanging out and surgeries and this is how you live your life, and that's not reality.
Susan, do you remember what your first thoughts were in, I think it was December of 1996, the first time you saw pictures of JonBenet Ramsey dressed like a little Las Vegas hooker?
I was
appalled. I had a six-year-old daughter who looked just like her sitting next to me and watching this on the news, and I could not believe it. Today, that's tame. It's become the accepted. Now, that was a shocking sexualization of a little girl, and we knew back then that something sexually had gone wrong there, yet I know that in terms of my own faith,
circus,
I felt
it. Peter, look, it was all chiefs, no Indians, but everybody down there, everybody, and this is part of what goes wrong on crime scenes, is that, you know, they're all in charge of what? I'm sorry, it doesn't make any sense. And so you had everybody kind of taken over, nobody did anything, and things got disarmed, diluted, and it was a mess. It was a circus.
Right.
So,
and
then on top
police,
of it, that little girl was all dressed up.
Sure. And are the police today, are they at odds with district attorneys where the police, you know, I wonder here in Waterville, are the police saying, we've given you everything, prosecute, go for it, you've got everything. In Missouri, now this is my own opinion based on people that I've spoken to and listening to statements, in the Baby Lisa case, I believe that they were this close to a confession, when Tacopina arrived from New York and put the brakes on the whole thing. I don't know how he sleeps at night. I don't know how the defense attorney is sleeping at night. There was a time in our country where
the hairs
a defense
on his
attorney
head and figures out what kind of gel to buy at the store that day.
A defense attorney's position job was to make sure there was no malicious prosecution. It wasn't a game of win at all costs and bury justice. This is all new. And so we're stupid ones. We're the ones that are electing attorneys to public offices thinking that this is going to help us somehow.
And
instead of electing – no, it isn't helping. I think that we should be electing law repealers rather than lawmakers, because they're the only one that seems to be benefiting in society is lawyers themselves from these things. It's crazy.
They become judges. They become the judges as well. And
exactly.
They're there to retire out, to get the pension. And forgive me if any of my judge friends are listening, because we have these arguments all the time. And that's all they care about. And they don't look at things as a matter of law. They don't decide to make decisions. Sometimes they won't sign warrants. We've changed. The judicial system is broken, and it's become lazy.
Steve Thomas said that Alex Hunter buried the police investigation into that murder in Boulder, Colorado back in 96, buried it. I hear rumors and rumblings that the police here are angry that there's been no charges brought up against the DiPietros. And they're saying, when is it happening? When is it going to happen? And the police are saying, find us the body. So I know that it's a tough situation for everybody. But there, I can't help but think that if we had one suspect behind bars for a parking ticket, getting a taste of what jail life will be like, we could get a story. In the disappearance of 13-year-old Haley Dunn, I said it from the very beginning, and I took a lot of flack from it at first. The child is dead because the mother spoke in past tense terms. Later on, information came out about drugs and child pornography and all this other stuff, and people said, yeah, 2 and 2 does equal 4. She's dead. Had they arrested somebody on the child porn charges, for instance, one or the other, they could have gotten information about where that child's body was. They could have broken them down. We're not seeing that as a strategy, and that is killing us.
Peter, we're out of time. And for everybody listening, Peter's coming back next week. He's going to fill in for Denny. Thank you to the Crime Wire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, public relations team at imaginepublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, June 5th, 2012. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you'd like your case to be featured on Crime Wire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Denny Griffin and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night. And Peter, thanks a million for being on.
Good night. Thank you.